From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
And I vowed to myself that no matter what happened to me in my life, that I would be there for other people.
Linda Chavez withdraws as Labor Secretary designate for violating the very anti-immigrant laws she supports. Depleted uranium becomes a politically radioactive issue, at least in Europe. We'll talk with a U.S. soldier hit by DU shrapnel and a British protester who helped pelt British Prime Minister Tony Blair with tomatoes yesterday. And the electric issue of power in California. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A broad coalition of liberal public policy groups said yesterday it's initiated a campaign against the selection of John Ashcroft to be Attorney General. The plan to defeat Ashcroft, a former Republican senator from Missouri, was announced as spokesmen for the coalition said the effort would be the largest ever mounted against a cabinet selection. The groups denounced Ashcroft's Senate record as extreme and placed Ashcroft at the conservative fringe of his party. Among the positions the coalition condemned were Ashcroft's opposition to abortion, gay rights, and gun control, and his support for the death penalty and the elimination of the National Endowment of the Arts. Ralph Neese, president of People for the American Way, said this is the worst executive branch nomination I have ever seen. The confirmation hearings will begin next Tuesday. One of the first witnesses against Ashcroft is likely to be Justice Ronnie White, the first black justice on the Missouri Supreme Court who was denied a federal judgeship largely through the efforts of Ashcroft. And this news from New York. The Giuliani administration has agreed to pay up to $50 million to settle a lawsuit filed on behalf of tens of thousands of people who were illegally strip-searched after being arrested for minor offenses, many of which fell under New York's crackdown on quality-of-life violations. The searches were conducted by jail guards in Manhattan and Queens during 10 months in 96 and 97. Many of the victims of the illegal searches were first-time offenders who were arrested for minor infractions like loitering, disorderly conduct, or subway offenses. The $50 million class action settlement could be paid out to more than 50,000 people who were arrested during the 10-month period. The lawsuit recounts several cases of men and women with no arrest records who said they felt humiliated as they were ordered to disrobe, to lift their breasts or genitals for visual inspections, and to squat and cough. The settlement would be the largest in a civil rights suit against New York City and appears to be one of the largest civil rights settlements against a municipality anywhere in the country. This news from Lincoln, Nebraska. The Nebraska Supreme Court has been asked to decide if a county sheriff should have done more to prevent a 1993 murder, which became the subject of the movie Boys Don't Cry. Tina Brandon, who often dressed as a man, was killed in retaliation for telling the police that two men had raped her after they learned her true gender. The men also killed two others who witnessed Brandon's death. In a lawsuit, Brandon's mother, Joanne, argues that the former Richardson County Sheriff should have arrested John Lotter and Marvin Nissen for rape before they had the chance to kill her daughter. The High Court is to hear arguments on Friday. And this news from Topeka, a newly elected Kansas Board of Education took a step toward restoring evolution to state science curricula more than a year after causing an uproar over how biology and faith should be taught in the classroom. After more than 2 hours of debate yesterday, the board decided it would give final approval to the new standards at its February 13th meeting. The new science standards would replace ones adopted in August of 99 that omitted references to many evolutionary concepts. Kansas is one of several states, including Arizona, Alabama, Illinois, New Mexico, Texas, and Nebraska, where school boards have attempted to take evolution out of state science standards or de-emphasize evolutionary concepts. This news from Burma. Opposition and human rights groups today will begin talks between pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi and Burma's military rulers. A senior Suu Kyi colleague said both sides must avoid provocations that could harm the dialogue. The United Nations revealed yesterday that the talks had been going on in secret since October. A National League of Democracy Executive Committee member said this is what we've been working for, and since it has begun, both sides have to be careful not to do anything to derail the process of confidence building. This news from Germany. Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder named new health and agriculture ministers today, replacing their embattled predecessors who left over mishandling of Germany's escalating mad cow disease crisis. Schroeder said the crisis that led to the hasty resignations yesterday had shown Germany's entire agricultural industry must be restructured with a view toward the consumer. For years, Germany insisted its domestically born herds were free of the disease. About 80 people have died of the brain-wasting disease in Britain alone since the mid-1990s. And finally, in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, recent days have seen a notable increase in Palestinians wounded or killed as they go about their daily business. Since the start of the new year, at least 5 people have been killed by gunfire in or near their homes or on their way from work. Human rights groups cite 2 recent factors that could be contributing to an upsurge in deaths or injuries among those not participating in clashes: severe restrictions on Palestinians' movement within the West Bank and Gaza, and what's reported to be a freer hand given to Israeli troops deployed in areas that are considered flashpoints. Throughout the wave of violence, which began in late September and has claimed more than 360 lives, the vast majority of them Palestinians, bystanders have occasionally found themselves in the wrong place at the wrong time. But human rights groups and Palestinians say for the first time, such casualties appear to be overtaking those among Palestinians taking part in stone-throwing confrontations or gun battles with Israeli troops. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! With Stevie Wonder singing I Ain't Gonna Stand For It. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
And good day to our listeners around the country as we begin to look at the first major stumbles of the incoming Bush administration.
That's right, Juan. It's quite something what we've seen over the last 24 hours. Yesterday, Linda Chavez withdrew herself from consideration for the post of Secretary of Labor in George Bush's cabinet. It wasn't her opposition to minimum wage increases, affirmative action, and union rights that sunk her nomination. Rather, the fatal blow is her apparent compassion toward a few individual immigrants. Ironically, the anti-immigrant rights movement Chavez has vigorously supported bears responsibility for criminalizing the act that Chavez admits committing, harboring, or employing undocumented immigrants. You know, it's very interesting if you look at Linda Chavez's stance against Zoe Bayard in 1993. She was taken out, Zoe Bayard, in her as a nominee for Attorney General under Clinton because she'd employed an illegal immigrant as a nanny and failed to pay Social Security taxes. But when Linda Chavez was asked about this, when she appeared on PBS's McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour in 93, she said, "I think most of the American people were upset during the Zoe Bayard nomination that she had hired an illegal alien. That was what upset them more than the fact that she did not pay Social Security taxes."
Well, but in Linda Chavez's case, apparently, as my colleague Michael Daly says in today's New York Daily News, at least Zoe Bayard paid wages to the person working for her. Here we have a situation where Linda Chavez basically said she wasn't employing a person who was cleaning her house, taking her dog out, doing various chores for her, but just occasionally giving her some money and, in essence, paying her with letting her stay in the house so that she was, in essence, exploiting the person that she was supposedly helping.
Well, in that case, maybe she was consistent because she is well known for opposing the minimum wage.
Yes, and this would be far below the minimum wage what she was paying there. But clearly, Linda Chavez has a major problem in terms of the policy she espoused for many years. In fact, had she not espoused the increasing the legislation that increasingly made it more difficult and more criminal for people to come into this country, especially if they were undocumented, she wouldn't have the problems that she had yesterday.
You know, yesterday in one of her statements, she said, I'll be very frank with you. I think I always knew that she was here illegally, referring to Marta Mercado, who lived in her house for several years. She said, I think I always knew she was here illegally. I don't check green cards when I see a woman who's battered and who has no place to live and nothing to eat and no way to get on her feet. And yet here is a woman who, that's Linda Chavez, who not only opposed the minimum wage affirmative action, but is also known for her mocking of sexual harassment regulations by writing that they are producing, quote, a nation of crybabies. We have a lot of interesting contradictions in the, well, former Labor Secretary designee, but let's hear some of her withdrawal speech yesterday.
I'm Linda Chavez. I guess you all know that. I guess everybody in America knows I'm Linda Chavez. Can't go anywhere these days. My, what a difference a week makes. I saw all of you about a week ago, and as I'm sure many of you will recall, I began this adventure by invoking my parents and by talking about where I came from and how I grew up. I didn't have an easy life growing up. I faced a lot of adversity, particularly in my young childhood. I had often one or another of my parents was in the hospital. My father got into a number of car accidents and spent a great deal of time in the hospital. So did my mother. And in every one of those incidents, there was always someone there to help me. Family members took me in. Friends helped. There was financial and other kinds of support for me when I was growing up and I needed it. And I vowed to myself that no matter what happened to me in my life, that I would be there for other people. And I've tried to do that. I have tried to live my life that way throughout my life. I've not led a perfect life. I don't think anybody has. I'm not Mother Teresa. However, I have tried to do right by people who have been in need. And some of that doing right by people recently has gotten me where I am here today. But in order to try to put in perspective some of the stories that have been out there over the last several days involving a Guatemalan woman whom I took into my home in the early 1990s, who came from a very abusive relationship, who fled Guatemala at a very time of turmoil in that country, who landed in the United States knowing no one and having no friends and having no place to live and no way to support herself, I was asked by a friend if I would, in fact, provide her a room in my home and try to help her so that she could get back on her feet and eventually return to her family in Guatemala. And I did that. And I did that even at the time, knowing that there was some risk to me in doing it. And I have to say to you today that knowing everything that has happened over the last week, that if that woman showed up at my door, if I was asked by a friend to do that again, I would do it in an instant without hesitation. I'd like to introduce some people to you today who have some stories to tell. And I have never been.
This is Linda Chavez introducing people who talk about her support for them, immigrants, now in this country. And an example of someone who didn't come, but whose family she helped.
I don't know if we're going to be hearing from Dr. David Bowden. Dr. Bowden and I have never met. He is on an airplane coming here from Florida. He called, I guess it was yesterday, or sent us an email and said that he wanted to help. I've never met Dr. Bowden, but back when I was in the White House, he was engaged to a Mexican woman who had inadvertently, during the process of her legalization, gone home, I guess, to visit her family. and was then informed that because she had left the country during this very critical period, was not going to be allowed to return and had, in fact, jeopardized her citizenship. And we have a letter here available if you'd like to read it. He wrote his congressman, David Bonnier. He wrote his senator, Carl Levin. They said, sorry, we can't help. At some point, somebody got him to write to the President of the United States, and I don't know exactly how it happened, but that letter ended up on my desk. And I picked up the telephone and called him and said, I will do what I can. And I called the INS on his behalf. I called the Department of Justice. And the long and short of the story is that Dr. Bowden's fiance was, in fact, allowed to return. They were able to get married. They have been married now for about 16 years. And I, frankly, had totally forgotten about this story until, August of 2000, I got a thank you letter from him. He had seen, somehow he'd come onto my website, found out where I was, and wanted to write me to tell me what an impact I'd had in his life. So if Dr. Bowden gets here, maybe he'll have a few words to say, and I certainly would love to meet him. I am here today in part with the folks around me to try to put a human face on a story. But I am also here because I think that what has happened over the last few days is quite typical of what happens in Washington, D.C., and unfortunately is very typical of what has happened in politics in America today. And I believe that what has happened is part of what we've seen over the last several years of the politics of personal destruction, is the phrase. I believe that I would have made a great Secretary of Labor. I believe that President Bush is going to make a great president. I worked very, very hard for his election, and I want his administration to succeed. Unfortunately, because of the way in which the stories have played over the last few days, the fact that all of you have made, I think, a great deal more of this story than need be, and have, in my view, not told the story of some of the people around me, I have decided that I am becoming a distraction, and therefore I have asked President Bush to withdraw my name for Secretary of Labor.
Linda Chavez, the former Labor Secretary designee, withdrawing yesterday. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Juan, we're joined on the phone now by Jean Butterfield, Executive Director of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Do you think it's fair to say, Jean Butterfield, that Linda Chavez is going down as a result of the very anti-immigrant laws that she has really very much supported over her years?
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement, Amy. I don't think Chavez certainly hasn't been a member of Congress or of the administration that's been sponsoring, drafting, and writing these laws, but I'm aware that she's generally supported them, and I'm not aware that she's been outspoken against them. I think she missed an opportunity yesterday, in fact, to talk about the lack of compassion in our immigration laws and the way in which someone, even who may have been trying to do the right thing, gets caught up in those snarls.
Well, what's amazing to me is when she talks about putting the human face on the entire issue, yet here we have thousands of people right now who are in immigration jails because maybe they committed minor offenses years ago. They're separated by hundreds of miles from their families, and we've got the most draconian policies almost in the entire history of the country in terms of the treatment of immigration. Of immigrants, and yet she didn't seem to have much concern for the human face of all these other people, only the ones that she directly came in contact with.
Right, and even, I mean, specifically in the instance of a refugee or anyone from Guatemala, you can talk about, and I think we should talk about, the history of discriminatory treatment under our immigration laws of people from that nation in particular. I mean, we have a whole history in which asylum cases from Salvador and Guatemala were misadjudicated and denied in the course of the late 70s, early 80s, and class members in a court case, the ABC case, American Baptist Churches versus Meese, won a settlement with the government in which the government agreed to go back and re-adjudicate all those asylum cases, admitting that it had discriminated. And so people from Guatemala were left in legal limbo for many, many years. And then again, just a couple of years ago, Congress passed the NACARA, Nicaraguan and Cuban Adjustment Act, and again left out Guatemalans and Salvadorans, giving them lesser treatment. Nicaraguans and Cubans were given green cards. Salvadorans and Guatemalans were told to go back and apply for something called suspension of deportation. And then just in this last congressional session, when the administration was arguing for parity for people from Guatemala, Salvador, Haiti, Honduras, again, Congress turned its back on people from those countries. So we have a whole sordid, two decades long at least, history of discriminatory treatment under our immigration laws for people from Guatemala. Exactly.
And then there's the final point of just what we call people who are undocumented in this country. You have Linda Chavez herself condemning Zoe Bayard at the time. It was at the time that Marta Mercado lived in her own house. And she said on McNeil-Lehrer, people are upset at the Zoe Bayard nomination because she hired an illegal alien. Mm-hmm. That was what upset them more, Linda Chavez went on to say, than the fact that she didn't pay Social Security taxes.
Right. And, you know, Chavez, I mean, I think there are many facts in dispute, obviously, and Chavez is maintaining she didn't hire this person. She provided her a room. The woman was working elsewhere. But regardless, there seems to be, you know, a big double standard and an obvious conflict in the law. The law doesn't allow for compassion, even if it was a situation where the woman was being given shelter because she was fleeing an abusive situation. Even so, someone who shelters a person like that can be charged with harboring a so-called illegal alien and prosecuted under our laws. So, you know, there really is no room for compassion, and there certainly has been a double standard in the treatment of Zoe Bayard as opposed to what some in the Republican Party wanted to maintain in this case.
Well, Jean Butterfield, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of American Immigration Lawyers Association in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to take a look at the exploding issue of depleted uranium. Is it causing soldiers and civilians to die of leukemia and cancer around Europe and possibly even here in the United States? Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Well, NATO ambassadors are meeting in Brussels today to try to defuse a growing crisis over ammunition tipped with depleted uranium. Several countries, including Italy and Germany, want the weapons banned after a rash of leukemia cases among former peacekeepers who served in the Balkans. The U.S. and U.K. are expected to argue that the armor-piercing shells are crucial to NATO's operational effectiveness. Yesterday, in a surprise move, Britain joined most NATO countries and announced it'll offer health screening to the thousands of soldiers who may have been exposed to depleted uranium during their tours in the Balkans. It was only last month that NATO disclosed U.S. warplanes fired 31,000 rounds in the 99 bombing of Kosovo, but also in Serbia and Montenegro. And in 94 and 95, Washington fired some 10,000 rounds of depleted uranium in attacks on Bosnia. We're joined right now by Scott Peterson. He's the Moscow bureau chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and we've had him on in the past when he completed a year-long investigation of the use of depleted uranium from Iraq to Kosovo. We're also joined on the phone yesterday by one of the protesters who helped pelt Tony Blair with tomatoes for his policy, the British policy towards Iraq. But Scott Peterson, can you lay out this growing scandal?
Well, I think what's remarkable is that after so many years where this issue has been one that people have paid attention to on a very back burner basis, that all of a sudden in the past week or two, it has blown up into a major, major story, and one that has kind of seized European governments and helped to cause quite a deep rift in the NATO alliance and really become something that we're hearing everybody from top to bottom discussing at the moment. So this is a remarkable thing, and I think something that especially the Iraqis, who have been making similar complaints for, you know, ever since the 1991 Gulf War, are probably kind of amazed and you know, seeing a bit of satisfaction for them that the issue is actually coming out into the open. The thing is that we don't know yet. There are obviously lots of deaths that have occurred, far too many than you would expect from a normal population of young soldiers. And at the same time, there are these allegations about that depleted uranium is responsible. But there are many, many different types of exposures and other things linked to Iraq and linked to Kosovo that are different and that really do spell out a different case in each sense.
And Scott Peterson, you're talking to us from Moscow, but can you tell us what your sense is of the impact of Britain's decision now to also participate in testing program among its soldiers?
Well, I think my sense about that decision is that it's not really done because the Brits think that they're going to find anything necessarily, but I think the British government has been under very strong pressure for being seen to be callous toward veterans. They've had this reputation throughout the issue with Gulf War illness, and in their view, this is a way, I mean, their sense is they really do believe that this is not dangerous, and therefore we're going to calm public fears by saying we too will prove by allowing soldiers and asking soldiers to be tested that it really isn't a problem. So I think that that's their primary push. I don't think that it's not done for the same panicky reasons that we're seeing in Italy or France or Belgium or other places where there have been several cases of leukemia, and in some cases, in Italy's case, there have been 30 cases of very severe problems, in fact.
We're also joined on the phone by Joanne Baker, who is one of the people involved with the rotten tomato toss yesterday, the throwing of tomatoes at the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, protesting sanctions on Iraq and overall British policy towards Iraq. Joanne Baker is a member of the Bristol Peace and Justice Group and an English teacher at the City of Bristol College, where Tony Blair spoke yesterday. Can you explain first what happened? Describe it to us.
Right. Hello. I'd first like to say that it was only one tomato, in fact, which was thrown, and that really we were just a group of ordinary people there, and we'd come to welcome Tony Blair in a way because we just want to express to him that we are just we're just very tired of being lied to. We're being lied to about Iraq, lied to about depleted uranium, and really I feel it's a crime against us as ordinary people in Britain and, in fact, in America as well, that we are not being told the truth about it, what is really, really going on. So, you know, that was our main complaint. And we're also outraged that our taxes are being used to bomb ordinary people in Iraq, even now, even today, you know, and we would rather have the same money spent on health, education, and things which we actually need in our country, and not to bomb innocent children and women, you know, in other countries. So, yeah, that was our main protest.
Well, you say tomato and we say tomato, but however you say it, I saw it all last night on CNN. The picture of Blair being hit with the tomatoes. How did you actually do it?
It was one person involved. She was very quick. She was just out there and had an extremely good shot. That was it, yeah.
There were three arrests.
Yeah.
Yes, what was the reaction of the rest of the crowd?
I think they were quite pleased, actually, yeah. know, I think we are quite sort of tired in Britain of his smugness, really. And there were people protesting there over all kinds of things, like old age pensions, farmers out there with tractors, people complaining about closures of schools and, you know, things like that. So I think everyone is a bit tired of it all.
Scott Peterson, you mentioned that the people of Iraq are suffering from depleted uranium as well, but what exactly does that mean in terms of rates of cancer and leukemia for the Iraqi population as a result of the Gulf War?
Well, I mean, the Iraqis have been suffering since the Gulf War from a whole host of different things. I mean, depleted uranium is likely to be one of the contributors to their health problems and other problems that they have. But they were exposed during the Gulf War to many, many other contaminants, things that really made the Gulf War battlefield a toxic stew. I mean, there were lots and lots of chemicals that were released by the Allied bombing during the Gulf War. Saddam Hussein used chemicals against protesters in the South at the end of the Gulf War. All of these things are, you know, things that can lead to the kind of cancers, the leukemia, the lymphomas, the birth defects, the congenital illnesses, things that have emerged and really taken root in Iraq in the last 10 years. And then on top of that, you've got those kind of health problems compounded by a collapsing health infrastructure, one that was kind of in decline anyway at the beginning of the Gulf War, and then the fact that there have been sanctions upon Iraq for all these years, and they really have been the strictest sanction regime in history. All of those things have added up to tens of thousands of casualties. When you're looking, though, at the specific role of depleted uranium, because there are so many problems and there are so many issues, it's not clear what role there that depleted uranium plays, and that's one of the reasons why it's difficult also to ascertain the role of what the depleted uranium does in Kosovo, because likewise there are lots and lots of different variables, different types of exposures, and it's difficult. You can't apply one case to the other.
Well, Scott Peterson, I'd like to ask you, we've been covering for over a year now the situation on the island of Vieques, Puerto Rico, where the Navy has admitted using depleted uranium in some bombing practices, although they say it was accidental. And many Puerto Ricans feel that the Navy has not come clean as to how extensive the use of depleted uranium has been on Vieques, where the cancer rate is the highest in all of Puerto Rico. Your research, did you find much difficulty in getting actual American figures on the use, the extent of the use of depleted uranium? Are you satisfied that you have a good handle on how extensive the use has been by U.S. forces?
Well, I think that we have a fairly good idea. In part, now we do, and I say that now because it was 6 years or so before or more after the Gulf War before details finally seeped out, and they weren't presented by the military, you know, to the rest of the world about the use of depleted uranium in Iraq. Everyone knew that the bullet had been used, but no one knew in what quantities or where. And it really took several Freedom of Information Act requests and others by people who were making investigations and journalists and others to try and get that information out. Now I believe we have a pretty full picture of how much was used in Iraq. But to give you an idea about how difficult it was to find out these details in Kosovo, I did my first investigation on the Kosovo depleted uranium use just shortly after the conflict ended a year and a half ago. The military, in fact, even the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is a UN group, was complaining that the United States and NATO were using this excuse that this was militarily sensitive information, quote unquote, in terms of the quantity of depleted uranium used, about the locations of where it was, and they didn't tell anybody for a year where that material was used. The United Nations was not informed for a year, and it wasn't until this last November that the UN depleted uranium assessment team was actually able to go out and go to the exact sites where these bullets had been fired. Of course, now UN officials are complaining that it had that information earlier. They might have been able to seal off some of these sites or remove some of the contamination. But it just shows how sensitive the military still continues to view this issue.
Scott Peterson is with us from Moscow. He's the bureau chief there of Christian Science Monitor. Also on the line with us, Joanne Baker from Bristol, the Peace and Justice Group there, an English teacher who helped to pelt Rotten Tomato, Tony Blair, with a Rotten Tomato yesterday for his policies around Iraq. And we're also going to go now to Las Lunas, New Mexico, to Jerry Wheat, who served in the Gulf War from 90 to 91, where he drove a Bradley armored personnel carrier. In 91, he was shot with depleted uranium rounds in what the Pentagon called friendly fire, and has subsequently suffered ill health, cancer in particular. Now, Jerry Wheat, the U.S. continues to insist that there's no link between exposure to DU, depleted uranium, and illness and death of soldiers?
Yeah, from everything I've gotten from the Pentagon, they're saying that there's no health effects from depleted uranium and that none of the soldiers were exposed to high enough levels to become ill from it.
So what has happened to you?
Well, since I've been back, I've had bad abdominal problems, where kidney pains and just abdominal pains. The day after arriving back to Germany, after dragging all my gear in that had been contaminated with depleted uranium, my oldest son was hospitalized for about 4 days. My wife miscarried once after in 1991 after I returned, when she had became pregnant. And then also my youngest son, he gets blisters on the palms of his hands and the bottoms of his feet, as well as rashes, and he was born after the Gulf. And I've also had a tumor that was developed inside the bone of my left arm after the Gulf War, which I've had to have removed.
Can you tell us the conditions under which you were exposed and how you discovered that it was DU, and what processes you went through in the Army to try to get some assistance?
Well, we were exposed when our armored personnel carrier was hit with two tank rounds. And at the time, the Army denied that they were depleted uranium rounds. They had said that we were hit by T-72 tank rounds, which supposedly are not depleted uranium. And the Army made no attempt to notify anybody that we, in fact, were hit with depleted uranium. It wasn't until March of 1992, where my daddy was an industrial hygienist technician for the Los Alamos Labs, decided to have some of the shrapnel tested that was removed from my body as well as my gear. And that's how I found out that I was hit with depleted uranium.
Because it was showed radioactivity?
It showed radioactivity, and I still have the shrapnel now, and it's still radioactive, even after all these years. It has a pretty high shelf life.
How many people were in the personnel carrier? What's happened to the rest of your fellow soldiers?
Well, we had about eight people in the personnel carrier. We had just evacuated another crew, and some of the crew are being examined up at the Baltimore VA, and they're doing the study on the depleted uranium. And pretty much everybody on the vehicle, with the exception of one person, was hit with some sort of fragments from the depleted uranium, as well as afterwards. Even after we were returned from the field hospital, we lived in this vehicle for over a week. There were cigarettes that were full of shrapnel that, you know, quite a few people were smoking. With a shrapnel in it, you'd be smoking a cigarette, and the shrapnel would fall out of the cigarette.
And what kind of treatment did you and the fellow soldiers get? In terms, did anybody say they're going to try to follow up on you and see what long term effects there were?
Well, initially, they didn't say anything. Matter of fact, some of the shrapnel that they had initially taken out of me, they conveniently lost out in the field. And, you know, we had heard that vehicles had been hit with depleted uranium rounds. And some of the shrapnel that I have was stuff that they had missed. That had came out of my body, and that's how I had that. When I got sick in 1991, I was being seen in an Air Force hospital, and they had no idea that I'd been hit with depleted uranium rounds because the Army hadn't investigated. They'd kept it really quiet. The Pentagon hadn't said anything. So the Air Force Hospital didn't have any idea what to look for. And again, it wasn't until after 1992 when I was telling the VA myself, you know, we were hit with depleted uranium rounds where they actually started looking. And I believe the first tests that they actually did weren't until December of 1993, which were, you know, that was several years after the Gulf War. So any high levels of depleted uranium had already came out of the bodies.
Jerry Wheat, do you have any hopes that with this new attention on depleted uranium, with Europe in an uproar, that it will help the situation for U.S. soldiers here?
Yeah, I'm hoping that the soldiers here in the United States will get better health care. The ones that were affected, there were thousands of people that were exposed to depleted uranium in the Gulf, whether it was through friendly fire or just being in the areas, climbing on the vehicles. And there's quite a few people sick. The Pentagon's denying it, but I'm one of the 33 that's being monitored in Baltimore, and every soldier that I've spoken to when I've been up there has had some sort of health effects.
Well, Jerry, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Again, Gulf War veteran who is ill with cancer now, hit by what the Pentagon calls friendly fire, hit with rounds of depleted uranium. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! It's certainly a story we will continue to follow. But when we come back, we're going to be looking at energy in California, what many are calling the electricity deregulation there, an energy nightmare. We'll stay with you. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Calling electricity deregulation an energy nightmare, California Governor Gray Davis said this week he proposed new state authority to buy and build power plants, urge Californians to reduce consumption by 7%, and threaten to seize control of private power plants if the situation becomes more extreme. Meanwhile, early today, high-level talks in Washington over the California energy crisis have ended without any solutions. In 1996, the California legislature unanimously passed a plan to deregulate California's $220 billion power industry on promises that market forces would lower costs. However, wholesale energy prices soared after the state sold some of its power plants to private companies. Some wholesale firms have seen profits rise over 200%. Two of the state's major utilities, PG&E and Edison International, say they've drained their cash reserves to buy power at the skyrocketing prices and that they face bankruptcy. The California Public Utilities Commission responded last week and passed the bill to consumers as it raised electric rates by 9% for residential customers of Edison and PG&E and up to 15% for businesses. There's been little word on why the wholesale prices soared in the first place. California officials and power industry executives are meeting again today. Well, we're going to talk about this issue with a few people, starting with Harvey Rosenfield, who is president of the Foundation for Taxpayer and Consumer Rights. Can you explain what's happening?
Well, it all goes back to a mistake that the legislature made in 1996 by deregulating electricity in the first place. For most of the 20th century, electricity was regulated. That was the paradigm that was used in state after state to protect the ratepayers against monopolistic abuses by utility companies. But then the utility companies got together with big business and spread a lot of money around in Sacramento, California, the capital. And what came out of that was a deregulation disaster. It was supposed to reduce our rates by 20%. There's a guarantee in the deregulation law that said that. Rates were supposed to be frozen for 4 years, during which time the utility companies were allowed to collect about $19 to $28 billion in excess charges from the ratepayers. After the rate freeze was over, the rates were supposed to go down. Last summer in San Diego, where the rate freeze was first removed, the average utility bill doubled and the price of electricity soared. Now, rates are still frozen throughout the rest of the state, ironically under the terms of the law that the utility companies themselves wrote when they thought it would continue to benefit them to do so. But the utility companies want to rewrite that law to remove the rate freeze and to be able to pass through to the ratepayers the enormous cost of electricity in the wholesale marketplace. And that is the immediate crisis we're facing in California, is the crisis of the utility companies demanding that they receive a second bailout within 4 years to the tune of about $10 billion from the ratepayers to pay off the higher cost of electricity, which have now exceeded the frozen rate for most people in the state.
Well, we're also joined on the phone by Joe Ellen Allen, who is the public affairs director for Southern California Edison and Edison International Company. Welcome to Democracy Now! Could you tell us why there has been this this major collapse in the idea of deregulation? Why have prices gone up instead of the promises of prices going down?
Well, in a truly deregulated market, one that is truly competitive, the idea is that prices should go down and the consumer should benefit. However, in this particular deregulation structure, there are some very serious flaws in that structure, including the fact that the utilities do not have the authority to choose to where they buy their power from. We are limited to borrowing our power at the power exchange, and that is a very flawed structure. Secondly, we were prohibited specifically, even though we asked, from engaging in long-term power purchase where we could buy power long-term for low prices and so on. This market is not working. But the word deregulation is really inaccurate. We were restructured. Southern California Edison and the other utilities are just as much, if not more, regulated than we ever have been because we do not have control over many of the business decisions we make. One of the reasons that I think the biggest reason that the prices have skyrocketed is because there was a capacity shortage. It's not something that's insurmountable, but there is a capacity shortage. However, the marketers and the generators have taken advantage of this and have gouged the customers, and we support the customers. The customers are absolutely right to be outraged because we are as well. There has been a study from a well-known economist at MIT, another one from the University of Portland, and others who have very clearly shown that there is market power being exercised and that the cost that is being given to us, which we cannot pass on to those who use the power, has nothing to do with the cost of creating a commodity. So the problem right now is gouging the customer and gouging the utilities.
Well, but Ms. Allen, in terms of the situation that, as far as the public knows, most of the public had no idea that deregulation was even occurring. So whatever legislation came out was largely as a result of the lobbying of the utility companies and others interested in this issue. So you're saying that you were not successful in getting the kind of deregulation that you wanted, and so now the customers are paying for it?
So far, the customers haven't paid for it. We have. We've been borrowing money. We have borrowed billions of dollars to keep the lights on in California and have been unable to pass any of that on to the people who are actually using the power. So we are not happy with that situation. But regarding deregulation.
Well, I know in New York, the prices of electricity for most consumers have virtually doubled in the past year. So we're facing in this state very similar problems, not as as emergency-like as you have in California, but certainly the prices of electricity have soared in this state.
Well, I think in your state you have a problem of heating oil being extremely high. In California, most of our electricity is created through natural gas because it is illegal to burn coal in California, which is a very cheap form of energy. But nevertheless, even with the fact that there is a capacity shortage and the cost of natural gas in California and across the nation has gone up, again, all of the evidence shows that the marketers and the generators are keeping the prices artificially high. And in fact, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission found as a legal finding that the prices in California are unfair and are unjust and unreasonable, and yet they have refused to act. We have sued the FERC asking that or demanding that they get refunds from these generators that are gouging the public and give some relief, and so far they have refused to act.
Harvey Rosenfield, is that your understanding of what the problem is, that the new folks who are generating the power are the ones that are gouging the public versus the old utilities that are transmitting the power now?
Well, the old utilities, like Edison, continue to supply a huge portion of their customers' needs. Whenever Edison talks about being broke and bankrupt and having to buy this power, it doesn't mention the fact that it, too, is a supplier of power because it retained a lot of its generation plants, only sold off, you know, 40-50% of that. But what concerns me is that I see in the last 48 hours that the utility industry and the energy companies and the right-wing political hacks who support so-called free markets have all begun this counteroffensive in which it's the problem wasn't deregulation, they say. It was the way California did it. Now, of course, it's one thing for Edison to claim that it was written poorly because, as you guys pointed out, they wrote it. So, you know, I don't have much sympathy for them. But let's go to the bigger question, which is this the problem of deregulation or just the way it was done here in California? And the answer is, you know, contrary to the, you know, some of the statements made in the last 48 hours, this capacity question isn't quite correct. A lot of capacity has come online. Some state studies that looked at this problem last summer found that the amount of the increase in consumption wasn't way so out of line to explain the massive increase in prices. And the Edison representative is correct in saying that some of these what's happened is you have a cartel of companies, a handful of companies, to which the utilities sold their power facilities. These companies basically control the market. And they have begun to manipulate the market by shortening supply at various periods of the day in order to cause staggering increases in the price and windfall profits of sometimes 500%. So that is the immediate, in other words, the immediate cause of the higher prices that the utilities are complaining about now are these in-state and out-of-state independent companies that have manipulated the price. But the ultimate cause of the disaster is deregulation itself and the notion that we should put in the hands of a bunch of greedy, profit-maximizing companies our energy future. It's just too important a commodity to the economy and the public health and safety to hand it over, as the politicians did in 1996, to the so-called free market. You know, it just doesn't. There can never be a free market for electricity. You can't store it. It doesn't travel very well, and it takes about $1 billion to get into the marketplace. And that's why we're in the fix we're in today. And there's never going to be a time when any company is going to say, "Heck, I'm going to build another power plant to make sure California has plenty of electricity." When in a free market, doing so simply undermines your ability to reap very high prices for energy.
Yesterday, Ari Fleischer, who is the spokesperson for President-elect Bush, was talking about the energy policy of the new administration. And he said all of this shows that we have to rely much more on domestic sources of energy. And he said the California energy crisis also shows we have to start drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. We're also joined on the telephone by Faith Gemmel, who is of the Nitsai Gwich'in tribe in the Arctic village. It is an Inuit tribe. What is your response to Bush's spokesperson?
We are an Athabascan tribe, and our response is that drilling in the Arctic Refuge would put the Gwich'in way of life at stake. It's a threat to our basic inherent human rights. Development would devastate our people culturally, spiritually, socially, physically. And it would be an act of genocide to another existing thriving culture, similar to the situation with the Plains tribes and the buffalo. And it's outrageous that we have to face this threat in the year 2001. When will this nation learn from past mistakes? Proposed development in the refuge is a short-term fix to a long-term problem. Instead, this country ought to promote energy efficiency and sustainable development, such as renewables.
Harvey Rosenfield, what about this issue of energy conservation? Clearly, the country had another scare with rising oil prices, but now the world price of oil has come way down, and yet still we're hearing the drumbeat now for new domestic sources of energy. Wasn't California supposed to be a leader in energy conservation?
Well, California was a leader in energy conservation until deregulation occurred, and once again, all the programs that California had to encourage conservation and renewable technologies fell victim to the free market, so-called free market, because nobody's interested in developing technologies that, like using the sun, whose energy can't be sold effectively. I want to first of all mention that all of this, a lot of information about this can be found on our website, which is consumerwatchdog.org. One of the things we've proposed in resolving the energy crisis here in California is to go to a public power-based system similar to that in effect in a lot of municipalities around the country. And as part of that, we give this, restore to the state the ability to plan and forecast for our energy needs into the future, something that a free market does very poorly, and then to determine how to meet those needs. And our first priority should be conservation, the use of renewable technologies, and only as a last resort, the construction of more power plants. I notice, that in the last 48 hours, everybody, all the free market ideologues are using the crisis in California as an opportunity to suggest more nuclear power plants. I mean, if it weren't so tragic what's happening here, it would be laughable how these folks are so predictable. You know, they create the crisis by getting legislation through, and then they come to the crisis's rescue with these discredited technologies like nuclear, which was the big problem in California that, you know, the utility companies were stuck.
We only have 10 seconds.
I'm sorry. I'll stop right there.
If people want to get in touch with the Foundation for Taxpayer and Consumer Rights, where can they go on the web or call?
ConsumerWatchdog.org or 310-392-0522.
Faith Gemmill, if people want to find out about the Arctic National Wildlife Reserve.
They can call 907-258-6814.
258-6814. 6814. And we're going to come back to this issue again. Also, Joe Ellen Allen, thanks for being with us from Southern California Edison. That does it for the program. And by the way, today is the 41st birthday of WBAI Radio. It should be a day of celebration, but unfortunately, we continue to be embattled with firings and bannings here. We want to thank our producers, Terry Allen and Chris Abrams, Anthony Sloan, our engineer, Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the studios of WBAI, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
This is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features David Brower on visions of the environmental movement. The myriad of environmental crises, from global warming to ozone depletion, are now fairly well known, particularly in the United States. Unless a comprehensive healing process is undertaken immediately to restore much of the damage done to the Earth, future generations may not have much of a livable planet left. There's still time to arrest the dangerous trends, but it will require radical new thinking, innovative approaches, and a concerted global.